Good evening, everybody, and it's great to be here. And thanks, Zimmer. And congratulations on keeping this great poetry event going for 7 years. It's a fabulous achievement. Much of what I write is concerned with trying to make sense of a totally changed Ireland. I was having this discussion with Paul earlier, and I look around and I despair because most of you are so fabulously young that I'm sure a lot of the references will be maybe something you have heard your grandmother maybe talking about. But I am endlessly interested in how the Ireland that I grew up in bears absolutely no resemblance to the Ireland we now inhabit. And I'm, as I say, fascinated by the life my parents lived as opposed to the life that I now find myself living. And to set the tone, a poem called The Wishbone. You know the old tradition of pulling the wishbone? Mm-hmm. Yeah, from the fowls, and you put your pinky around the little shard of bone, and whoever gets the biggest splinter is favoured by fortune. Would it were so easy. The wishbone. After the Sunday dinner, my parents crooked their fingers round the wishbone, tugging lightly on either side of that frail forked sternum. They hankered and hoped as they pulled the small wings of bone, waiting for the jagged, slippery break of fortune to favour one of them amongst the potato skins and the bones of custard. Mm-hmm. So that was what we did for entertainment of a Sunday. Oops, it is. Sorry, no. Sorry. Skidding and flying. Thank you. Many of you will have had the bitter experience of shutting up a house. Before it goes on the market for sale, and it fell to my sister and I to do that after my mother's death. It's a grim and terrible task, and anything that provides distraction is of course heaven sent, and heaven did send distraction in the shape of a beggar man, and he got such a reception that I would say he was completely confused by what happened. In luck. On the day after Mother's funeral, we unfurled the black plastic sacks for her possessions. Sweat dark shoes, bunions stretched and unbearable. A little shifty beggar soft coughed his way into our grim work. Giddy with grief, my sister and I lavished attendance on his bemused reserve. Turned Mother's empty house into a cradle of hospitality, crinkled the fire, laid a cloth, scrambled his eggs, and when he left, pockets full of large bottles and cigarettes, he pedalled away on our prized rally, freewheeled somewhere. So the little beggar said a very faithful thing to us when he was going. He said, "Are ye here every day?" His ship had come in. He had found this nest of lunatic women who were giving away possessions. My mother at the zoo. Ireland in the 60s, without theatre, without cinema, with black and white television and the Irish press, you know. And yet, you know, we did not live by bread alone. We had our own way of making bread and circuses. And my mother, on a very rare trip to the zoo, and you know those lovely monkeys with the coloured bums, the mandrills, and they're so proud of how they look. My mother at the zoo. When the monkey in the zoo mooned my mother with his coloured backside, she drew near the cage for a closer look. Intrigued by his ostentatious flaunting, she studied the lurid swing of his tail end, his wattled skin, a graphic blue and red on swaying buttocks. She stayed a long time with that monkey, admiring him, absorbing his exotica. God bless the monkey. 35. Meat is, I think, sociologically a very male food, I suppose, tied up with the hunting, gathering and all the rest of it. It's, you know, the man who carves and pronounces on the meat. And certainly it was my father's task to render. I don't know if you've seen old people rendering meat and saving the fat. The meat. My father bought the meat. Cheap cuts bleeding through brown paper, looped to the handlebars with string. Absorbed, he performed a kind of alchemy, rendered fat into dripping, poured the greasy stream into opaque marmalade jars, controlled this molten hiss. At noon each day, my mother sharpened the knives, sparked steel on the doorstep until the blades grew thin as the neighbor's cats clawing for scraps, their nails primed, their eyes flint. Mm. 18. We have all had bulls come into our china shops. We have all had our hopes pulverized. Bull in a china shop. It is best to be pliant when a bull hurtles into your china shop. As you contemplate your calm lateral figures, their surfaces smooth and passive, be mindful of his snorting and pawing, the heavy swing of his testicles. Accept his capacity to pulverize. After the initial shrieking and flapping, crouch and be still. Concede that he will demolish your Wedgwood. The dense, impenetrable blueness of it will flake to dust. Glazed statuettes and vases, their luster pooling in glassy crevices, will shatter. Around you, exotic things will be a luminous and fragile scattering of shards. The fine bone china will splinter to needles. The bull will care nothing for your dynasty marks, the stylized motifs of grasses and waterfowl, the peace you find in opaline things. In the aftermath, the silence is surreal. Your hands will go out to some crude, thick vessel that held out against the onslaught. Most likely, you will be found cradling it, crying softly. Wishbone. Okay, so back to the Ireland of the 60s. It's no wonder abuse happened in the institutions, because when I was about 8 years of age, a neighbour decided, a widow, farming, strong farmer, decided that she wanted a live-in companion. So my mother and I were chosen as the chaperones, or the people to go with her, to get a live-in companion. It was like, I suppose, going to the pound, maybe, for a rescue dog, because she went to the county home, right, the old county home in Cashel, St. Patrick's. And as it happened, none of the people brought before her passed muster. But looking back on it now, 40-something years later, she could have come home with 20 of those people with her. There was absolutely no questions asked about where these people might be going or what might be ahead of them. Congenial company. When I was 8, my mother and I went with Bridget Hogan to Cashel, for she searched for a live-in companion amongst the inmates of the county home. Bridget took her place on the interview panel, nodded her thanks to the ward's maid who brought Marietta biscuits and orange squash on a tray. The nurse led a procession of misfits before us. Bridgie considered the frail and insane, quizzed the lumpen and mottled, viewed the thick, bulbous features of drinkers, looked for signs of dulled aggression in the muted, asked the woman with the doll's face if she smoked. My mother, when queried, said they were all a bit dodgy. Bridgie, disappointed amongst the misshapen and freakish, apologised to the matron, who reassured that there was no harm done. Subdued on the bus going home, I wished they'd chosen one from the ranks of the mad. Picture the strange group we'd have made. Imagined the conversation. Bridgie, all business, laying down the law. The bus driver, listening in. Scattering ones. Oops. Oh dear, this is not a working arrangement. Thank you. Thank you. I suppose one of the tragic and huge changes that I see all around me all the time is suicide, the prevalence of death by suicide. And unfortunately, the county where I live now, Wexford, has a huge representation, second only to Mayo, for being overrepresented on the statistics of persons who die by suicide. And I remember the very first person I heard of who took his life when I was in first year at secondary school, back in the early 70s, and it was inconceivable. I remember that, you know, the news was whispered around the classroom, and we stopped the teacher to tell her. You know, it was absolutely, totally shocking. And it was doubly shocking, I think, too, was because it was a very wealthy person. So, terrible to think. Terrible to think the Golden Vale acres didn't save him. His fields teeming with Frisians, glittering black and white with health. Or the aga in the kitchen. His woolen socks kept warm in pairs by the wife who won every prize going at the agricultural show for exotic stuff we could hardly imagine. Fig jam, seed cake, big tight marrows patterned like snails. Terrible to think the brother, a priest, wasn't enough, or the cousin, a solicitor, or his mother, a proud dowager known in every parish as a lady. Terrible to think the one longed for near miracle of a child wasn't enough. The shining girl destined for greatness at the convent school, the sheepdog bounding after her bicycle. Terrible to think he took the shotgun that morning, a week short of Christmas, blasting himself from his wife, his daughter, the farm, the aga, the pots of jam, the fair-eyed socks. The news whispered in disbelief that the man from the hill had done away with himself, leaving his widow white as flour in a black fur hat propped up between her sisters, his daughter lost amongst her cousins. To change tone, with public examinations coming up. If you were looking for a maths grind for your child, just be really careful if a very dapper man carrying a pigskin bag should darken your door. He came well recommended, a diffident dapper man in a bow tie, raised his hat to the lady of the house. He was old world with politeness, a loner's eccentricity, had the bachelor's fondness for homemade cake. Maths, he said, was the queen and servant of the sciences, a discipline both intellectual and aesthetic, a great pleasure properly understood. He'd do his best for the boys who laboured over unknowns, struggled with the laws of probability, the mysteries of Pythagoras. His practice was to reward honest effort. he explained, stroking his pigskin bag to warm life in his lap, his trove of enticements to encourage good lads. Every stumbling attempt was celebrated with a glimpse of breast or thigh flashing from creased magazines teased from the warm interior of his satchel. A bag he described as soft and beautiful, the skin responsive to his non-abrasive care, menstruations of baby shampoo and oil lovingly applied to keep it supple. So they got more than they bargained for with the with the Latin teacher. Wakes were a great bit of distraction, I'll tell you now. And people who were fond of a drink would go from house to house where bodies were laid out. And they always had this totally irrefutable kind of calling card. They would say they were friends of the corpse. No way of the corpse was not in a position to and there was another old one, all grandeur and all the rest of it, who went to Wakes. To Steve, souvenir hunting. The magpie, Hennessy, professional funeral goer. All faded grandeur and good manners amongst the peeling wallpaper of the pianos and poverty dead, perched beside the corpse in her dilapidated fur coat, sweetly musty, a sharp-eyed stoat around her neck, offered her kiss, her cheek for the genteel kiss, a little shower of face powder falling like whitewash in the refined exchange. Accepted a tincture of sherry. A great intoner of the rosary, joyful and sorrowful mysteries rang from her painted lips, florid with detail and emphasis. All reverence and black mantilla, she took a bird's eye view of the parlour, eyed up the antiques, identified a little souvenir she could spirit into her voluminous handbag, a token the corpse would not begrudge her. So again, the corpse was not best placed to protect his property. One of the biggest things you can be proud of as Cork people is the mercy shown in Glendore in January 2012 with the sinking of the Tivonan, and how the people down there got the People of the Year award for their great mercy. And as always, it is the small acts of kindness that carry such weight and such power. And one of those acts, you remember there was two Irish men and three Egyptians lost in the tragic trawler tragedy, and the women down there started to cook Egyptian food and bring it to the quay. So, you know, very, very nice act of kindness. Mercy shown at Union Hall. That January, the women of Glendore learned how to slow burn turmeric and cumin to spice dishes of lamb. Their kitchens were alive with the tang and zest of garlic and lentils, luscious with fig bread and semolina cake. Food kept warm between towels as they drove to the quay, where the distraught Egyptians waited for news of the trawler men, Ali Eldin, Wael Muhammad, Ateya Shaban, the savage water lit with tea lights and candles, their flames frail and flickering. Well, well done to the people of Union Hall. Okay. In view of it being Easter, two poems that look at maybe celebration of faith or fate, and one thing that I love to see in the Mediterranean countries is the larger than life, the big way that faith and supplication is embraced in a really Baroque, Rococo kind of way. And this poem is set in Cyprus, and down the little narrow streets you would see, and old women selling them from prams, big candles shaped like feet or hands or your head or your heart, your lungs, any organ that is diseased. And the idea is that these big VC candles are lit before the icon. Waxworks. In a street market in Nicosia, an old woman sells strange candles from a pram, body parts made of wax. The afflicted buy these greasy symbols of their sickness, crudely fashioned into lungs, hearts, kidneys, hurt limbs, sightless eyes. They lick the wicks, ignite these mute blobs, leave them to burn before a shrine, petitioning a cure from the patron of various diseases. Streets away, I noticed a child, his legs and arms docked to terrible pink triangles. I can't imagine what calamity consumed his hands and feet, but his mother is, I'm sure, familiar with the gallery of tallow, models of toes and fingers dripping in the gruesome heat before an impassive icon in supplication. I presume the child may have had meningitis. And the next one set in Malta, St. Paul's Church, where Paul was reputed to have been shipwrecked, and his wrist bone is kept in a reliquary there. And again, on Holy Thursday, when the sarcaston was about, you know, this indescribably rich, sumptuous kind of work that he was doing, and I watched him and then thought about maybe the kind of life he lived when he wasn't about this business. Service. The sarcaston in St. Paul's Baroque Church works all day in the sumptuous hush of this dark interior. Quiet amongst the icons and treasures, he buffs the candlestick to glossy lustre, burnishes the silver with his breath, checks his reflection in the gleam. In his soft shoes he glides to the nave and aisles, genuflex before the venerated remains in the glittering reliquary. Over him the ceiling frescoes are florid, the dome rococo. On feast days he simmers lemon rind and cinnamon sticks until the heady musk wafts to the gilded plaster and marble, pervades the internal architecture. His home is cool and plain and spare. The surface is ceramic. His wife is careful with the light cottons he favours in this Mediterranean heat, mindful of his preference for lamb stew, the sweet tooth she satisfies with honey cake. So we all pay our homage to somebody or something. Scattering lawns. And I will finish with how we made in my growing up our own rituals, our own faith practices. On the last day of April, just before May Eve, I don't know if it was a practice down here in Cork, but certainly at home in Tipperary, the land would be sprinkled with Easter water. And it would be the man of the house who would do it, assume the role of a kind of voodoo priest. And the idea was that that was the day when the veil between the concrete and actual world and the spirit world was very thin. And it was also at the time when you were very vulnerable, because it was the time when you could be hexed. And the hexing assumed the shape of gluggers. People who have studied folklore will be very familiar with all of this. The gluggers, the rotten eggs that would be put in straw onto your land so that it would take the fertility from the cows. And similarly, rotten meat would be put to curse your land, curse the fertility of your life, basically. So it was an important ritual that was conducted, and I will finish with this poem called My Father Practicing Voodoo. On May Eve, my father, exotic as a voodoo priest, sprinkled Easter water on our half acre of land, protecting us from the malign intentions of the bad-minded, those who would fix the evil eye on us. He shielded us from the malicious nest of rotten eggs, gluggers in straw, putrid in the ditch, cursing our garden to stalk and decay. The rank stink of harm led him to the rotten meat in the grass. We followed at a distance our priest father, mediating between worlds on our behalf. Our respect was assured as he sat to his food, eating like a man who had claimed authority over the blight and hex of misfortune. So let that be my wish for you.